From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. John McPhee's essays combine the precision of good reporting with the grace of good literature. His books have explained the forces of nature and described man's attempts to gain control of nature. On this edition of Fresh Air, John McPhee discusses the control of language. Also today, writer Terry McMillan. She describes herself as a single mother who'd like to be in a relationship, but she's tired of men who expect her to be misunderstanding, miss help boost his ego, and miss always put him first. Terry McMillan tells us how the men she's shown the door inspired her novel Disappearing Acts. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album from alto saxophonist Tim Byrne, and TV critic David Bianculli previews the season premiere of Beauty and the Beast. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. President Bush today tried to defend his decision to send a top U.S. official to China, saying he wanted to find common ground with the world's most populous country. Bush said he plans no further sanctions against Beijing for its violent repression of student reforms. According to the president, National Security Advisor Brent Scowcroft's weekend visit to Beijing was to brief Chinese leaders on the U.S. Soviet summit in Malta and did not signal a resumption of normal relations. But Bush is under heavy pressure to explain Scowcroft's mission more fully. Senate Democratic leader George Mitchell condemned the move as kowtowing and said he was disturbed to see newspaper pictures of Scowcroft exchanging toasts with the very Chinese leaders who ordered tanks to crush the pro-democracy demonstrations. Lawrence Walsh, the Iran-Contra special prosecutor, this afternoon disclosed that he's been rebuffed in efforts to meet with President Bush to work out problems dealing with classified information in the Iran-Contra trials. Walsh's disclosure came in a 60-page report to Congress. NPR's Nina Totenberg has more.
On October 19th, with the prosecution of a former CIA station chief about to go down the drain because of classified information, and with Walsh looking ahead at the trial of former National Security Advisor John Poindexter, the special prosecutor wrote to President Bush. Walsh told the president that he was not receiving the same cooperation from the Bush White House that he had from the Reagan administration. The broad question, said Walsh, is whether this administration will tolerate an enclave of high public officers free from the rule of law simply because those officers deal exclusively with classified information. Walsh asked the president to meet with him to discuss the classification problem and possible solutions, but the president did not respond. Instead, the president's counsel, C. Boyden Gray, wrote Walsh a brief letter saying that such a meeting would be, quote, inappropriate. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
In Hong Kong, an operation is underway to send home against their will a group of Vietnamese boat people. The BBC's James Miles reports from Hong Kong.
At 3 in the morning local time, about 100 prison officers dressed in riot gear arrived at the Phoenix House Detention Center. The Vietnamese apparently suspected what was about to happen, and as the officers approached, some of the boat people cried and shouted through the windows. Some of them displayed a placard saying, "Where are you, humanity?" After police and plainclothes officials had talked to them, they packed their bags and boarded a convoy of vans without any apparent force being used. The boat people were taken to the airport, where they boarded a chartered plane for Hanoi. A government spokesman said no force was used and that everybody was very calm.
The BBC's James Miles. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 3 points to close at 2728.24. Declines led advances 4-3, volume 147 million shares. This is NPR News. In Lebanon, there's been a flare-up in fighting in the Christian enclave between the powerful Lebanese Forces militia and troops loyal to General Michel Aoun. At least 3 militiamen were wounded in a gun battle apparently sparked by a road accident. Mike Theodulu has more from Nicosia.
Lebanon has a striking capacity to contain many different conflicts within its borders. Today's brief but potentially explosive gun battle between the two groups that control the Christian enclave, the Lebanese Forces militia and Aoun soldiers, comes just days after bloody clashes in Beirut's Muslim sector between rival Shiite groups. On top of all this, the country is still braced for a showdown between President Harawi and General Aoun, who refuses to leave the presidential palace. As with so much bloodshed in Lebanon, today's clash was triggered by an apparently minor incident. The militia says it was the result of a car accident. Other Christian sources, however, put it down to an argument between a group of militiamen in one car and 2 soldiers in another about which side was the stronger. Last February, a minor quarrel at a ski resort triggered fighting between the two groups, in which more than 60 people were killed. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Theodulu in Nicosia.
More than 100,000 East German pro-democracy supporters rallied in Leipzig today for the fourth straight week. The demonstrators appeared to be split over a call for German unity, however. Several thousand people also demonstrated in the southeastern city of Dresden today, also split into supporters and opponents of German reunification. Reunification has become an increasingly bitter topic for East Germany's new forum opposition group. The head of the International Monetary Fund said today he expects Poland to complete an economic reform plan this week, opening the door for massive financial aid for the West. IMF Managing Director Michael Cassidamus said he did not offer details, but he characterized the plan as courageous and said the IMF would undertake a debt reduction program as well. I'm Frank Stacio, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. John McPhee is one of America's most respected and envied writers, respected for stretching the artistic dimension of reporting, as William Howarth once put it, envied because his status as a New Yorker staff writer has allowed him to spend months or years on a story and to take as many pages as he needs to tell it. As for subject, McPhee writes about people, places, and phenomena that interest him. He's written profiles of tennis star Arthur Ashe, basketball player and Senator Bill Bradley, curator Tom Hoving, and physicist Ted Taylor. His interest in geology and the outdoors has led to pieces on Alaska and the Pine Barrens. His essay Oranges told the botanical processing and marketing history of the ever-popular citrus fruit. McPhee lives in Princeton, where he grew up. He's been a staff writer at The New Yorker since 1965. Most of his New Yorker pieces are later published in book form. His latest book, The Control of Nature, features three reports about attempts to control threatening natural forces, a river, a volcano, and landslides. I asked McPhee what led him to this subject.
I have a daughter named Sarah who was in college in the 6 or 7 years ago and was taking a course from Robert Coles on the work of Walker Percy. And she was totally swept away by Walker Percy and wanted to go to Walker Percy country for a spring vacation. And I said, fine, we'll go down there, but what's in it for Dad? And after some research, what was in it for Dad was a canoe trip in the a brief one in the Atchafalaya Swamp with an LSU professor and another friend of ours. And the four of us went out into the swamp. And while I was there, I learned that all of the water in the swamp was controlled by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers at a place called Old River, where they were valving the Mississippi and preventing it from going off in a direction in which the Mississippi wants to go, but in which the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers wanted it not to go. And I thought that was a wonderfully symbolic situation of the flat-out struggle between human beings and nature, because the Mississippi has greatly shifted its course down there about once every 1,000 years. And the time had come in the 1950s and thereabout for this to happen. And so they're down there trying to prevent it. And when I got the idea of doing a piece on that and all its implications and ramifications, I thought of doing more pieces in the same theme. And a man at the Waterways Experiment Station in Vicksburg said, well, if you're interested in this theme, you ought to go to Los Angeles and look into the debris basins. And I said, you know, the debris basins? And he said, yeah, they're catching the falling rocks of the San Gabriel Mountains to keep them off Johnny Carson and so on.
One of your three pieces is called Los Angeles Against the Mountains, and it's about the debris flow. There's a paragraph in that I'd like you to read that kind of describes the magnitude of the debris.
In geology, it would be known as a debris flow. Debris flows amass in stream valleys and more or less resemble fresh concrete. They consist of water mixed with a good deal of solid material, most of which is above sand size. Some of it is Chevrolet size. Boulders bigger than cars ride long distances in debris flows. Boulders grouped like fish eggs pour downhill in debris flows. The dark material coming toward the genophiles was not only full of boulders, it was so full of automobiles it was like bread dough mixed with raisins. On its way down Pine Cone Road, it plucked up cars from driveways and the street. When it crashed into the genophile's house, the shattering of safety glass made terrific explosive sounds. A door burst open. Mud and boulders poured into the hall. "We're going to go," Jackie thought. "Oh, my God, what a hell of a way for the four of us to die together."
It's really wonderful descriptive writing in that paragraph. I really like the Chevrolet-sized boulders. I think it was just the right word to use. How do you choose your subjects? Actually, what I'm wondering is if you've ever bailed out of a subject, if you've ever started to write about a person or a phenomenon or a place and decided that you made the wrong choice and you weren't going to go through with it.
Early in the process, early in the cycle, I mean, you know, you get an idea and then something begins that might fetch up a year or two, certainly months, but maybe a year or two or three later with a finished piece of work. And very early, something might not work out. Or after some travel, but I've never begun. If I begin writing something, I think it's going to be okay, or I wouldn't be beginning it. And then there's so much just difficulty along the way, and I lose confidence so much that if I were to quit at that point, I wouldn't know whether it was because it wasn't working out or because I was chickening out. So I always finish.
Mm-hmm. My guest is writer John McPhee. I've always thought of your style in part as finding the macrocosm and the microcosm, looking at something very specific and looking at it so carefully that suddenly things much larger, ideas much larger begin to emerge. And this one person or one phenomenon that you're looking at becomes almost a metaphor for things larger than itself. Does that jive at all with the way you see your kind of writing?
Well, I sort of hope that happens. I'm glad to hear you say that. but I don't, I think it would be dangerous to sit down and say, and force something like that. You know, you just by attending to the story you're trying to tell, you may hit such a level. But I don't consciously try to do that.
Mm-hmm. What's the longest amount of time you've ever spent on one story?
3 years.
And which one was that?
Coming Into the Country.
What was it about Alaska?
About Alaska.
And you lived there for the full 3 years, or
no,
you went back
oh
and
no.
forth?
No, I went up there about 4 times for visits ranging from 6 weeks to 4 months. And in the rest of the time, I was at home in Princeton, New Jersey, where I live, working on that piece at home. There was a great deal of reading involved, and of course, the writing always takes longer. I was figuring the other day, it takes about 7 days in Princeton for every one that I'm out somewhere, generally.
I mean, 7 days of writing?
Yeah, I mean, people will ask me, does your family miss you? And I say, they're only too happy to get rid of me because I'm back there writing, you know, 7 or 8 days for every one that I'm traveling. And furthermore, the writing goes on. I mean, it might last 15 months, the 15 months of writing. And if you've ever lived with somebody who's doing 15 months of writing, you'd be glad to get rid of them too. And so then the time comes up and I go off for a couple of weeks and then come back again. That's how it works. It's most of the effort is at, you know, in the locked away in a room by yourself.
Do you feel really differently about the part of your work which takes you out into the world, out to, say, Alaska, and the part of your work which keeps you in your room with the typewriter locked up writing?
I certainly do. And there's a cycle that I mentioned earlier, and the part that when I'm out in Alaska is really quite splendid, and I'm very lucky to be there and to be able to do that. And the part when I'm doing the writing is a process in which I begin with zero confidence every time and gradually build up a little bit over a very long period of time as this the writing itself slowly accumulates.
What's responsible for the zero confidence when you know your track record?
I don't know, but I can tell you that I'm telling you the truth.
Yeah, no, I don't.
But I don't
know. Doubt that,
I mean, I don't know why. I don't. If it's the first draft, maybe this. When you are putting together a piece of writing, in its initial phase, you have nothing, and you are trying to suspend your life so you can recreate something that went on in life a little before, and you do not write well right away. And if you're going to get anything done at all, you have to blurt out something, and it's going to be bad. And to sit there and do something that's bad all day long is unpleasant. But when you've done this enough, you have the so-called rough draft. And at that point, when I do have a draft, something's on paper and it's really miserable, I change a little. When I'm confronting material that exists, the writing that actually exists, I can work on it and make it better. And I relax a little and I get a little more confident when I'm in that second, third phase, or whatever, how many times it takes.
You're notoriously obsessive about your writing. Can you describe how you organize the notes that you've taken back with you from the place that you've been writing about?
Well, I copy them all first on a typewriter, it used to be, and now it's in a hard disk. And then when all the notes are assembled in this one document, I study that and look for a structure for the piece of writing that will rise out of those notes, rise organically out of the material that I have there, and not be imposed from the outside. I mean, a prefabricated structure is not what I would want to find, but an organization, a sequence for the material that I would be dealing with, and that makes sense and that yields the best result through juxtapositions of things and whatever can legitimately be done within the context of a factual piece of writing. And that excites me quite a bit, and it might last for several weeks with a long piece as I try to figure all this out and then arrange it so that when I begin a piece of writing, I always know where it's going to end and where it's going to go. The notable exception to this is that I haven't mentioned is that I always write a beginning, a lead first, because that really primes the pump. If you have a successful lead and you know that it works and it makes sense in terms of the piece, that it doesn't promise too much, and that it arrests attention in a fair way, then I stop and go back and do all that organizing I'm talking about.
Can I read you the lead from the first essay in The Control of Nature?
Please.
And I'd like to know how you hit on this and knew that this would be the way to start. 300 miles up the Mississippi River from its mouth, many parishes above New Orleans and well north of Baton Rouge, a navigation lock in the Mississippi's right bank allows ships to drop out of the river. In evident defiance of nature, they descend as much as 33 feet, then go off to the west or south.
So why did I use that lead?
Yeah.
Well, you see, the ships are dropping out of the river and going off to the west or south. If that's happening, the river must want to go there too. So we have the very basic situation, but it's presented in terms of the ships and in a way that I hope will
Exemplify?
Or? Yeah, exemplify it and make somebody want to find out, hey, why is this? Why would a big boat go out of the Mississippi River 300 miles from its mouth and go downhill on water? There's something odd about that. And, of course, the something odd about that is what the whole piece is about. And I like to say that a lead ought to shine like a flashlight down into the whole piece, if possible. And I hope that one does.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to talk with you more about your writing, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is John McPhee. We'll be back after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is John McPhee, who's one of America's most revered writers and has been at The New Yorker for around 25 years. His new book, The Control of Nature, is about man's attempts to alter nature to ward off natural disasters. Now, you were talking about organizing the notes that you bring home. Physically, how do you organize it? Physically, how do you organize all the information you have before you've actually written it up?
Say I've decided that there are 16 parts of this story. This is just by making little notes as I go along and then looking at those notes, boiling them down, and then I end up with the idea that my body of notes, 55,000 words of notes or whatever it is, this body of notes is going to work out in 16 parts, but I don't know what's first, second, third, or fourth. And then I might put a little something on a 3x5 card that identifies each of those 16 parts. And then I will look at those cards for a long while to see relationships. What might go next to what? Some things have to be where they are because that's when it happened, but you can use flashbacks, flash forwards. There's all sorts of ways, quite legitimately, to arrange a piece of writing. And what you're looking for is to have this material yield the best dividends through structure. And then I go through the whole body of notes and look at each note, and I go down from one note to another and assign it to one or another of those 16 places. And I used to then tear up the notes with a pair of scissors or something, but I have a friend at Princeton named Howard Strauss who has written stuff for my computer which causes it to, it'll dive into those notes, it'll take the whole 55,000 words, it'll throw them up in the air, it'll fluff them up to about 75,000 words, and it'll cause them all to settle down into 16 files with 16 names attached to them that are all in the hard disk and the original preserved too, and all this occurs in 4 minutes while I sit there watching a red light.
Right.
But it's the same thing I used to do with Xerox and stuff like that. And it sounds very mechanical, all this, but the purpose is to separate the material, to put it away so that when I'm doing a given section, one of those 16 things, I know what's in it, I can read over those notes, and thus I'm liberated to write. I have no excuses. That's the purpose. The purpose is to, of all that, is to get me out into no man's land where it's just myself and this machine now, the computer that I stare at all day.
My guest is writer John McPhee. You had told an interviewer for the New York Times that back when you were getting started writing after college, when you were writing for a TV drama series, Robert Montgomery Presents, that you used to every morning put on your bathrobe and, you know, put the tie around it and then use that tie to tie yourself to the chair so that you'd stay put by the typewriter and write.
The sash or cord, that, you know, whatever it is in a bathrobe that goes around your waist.
Yeah.
And the chair was a so-called captain's chair with the vertical spindles, you know, around mm-hmm. the back. So mm-hmm. I threaded it in and out of that and then around me. And one time the doorbell rang. I was in an apartment in New York, and I stood up to go answer the door, and the chair got up with me.
Well, did that help, actually tying yourself to the chair?
No, it's just an illustration of how miserable writing can be. And, and I mean, I'm not a sedentary person. I don't belong in a chair.
Uh-huh. So what do you do now to keep yourself in the chair?
Well, I'm older, and I can sit still a little better. And that was, you know, I was 23 years old or something like that, 24, when that happened. And I've been at it so long, I actually sort of relish the time alone. I have no difficulty sitting in that room for all those hours by myself, because I guess I just learned to do that through time.
Mm-hmm. Although you spend much of your life talking to people for pieces that you'll be writing, you actually do very few interviews yourself. I mean, you allow yourself to be interviewed very seldom. And I was wondering why.
Well, I don't know. It's complicated. First of all, I'm always behind in my work. But for another thing, it's my work that I hope that will be known, not so much myself. I mean, I enjoy doing this once in a while, but I prefer just to publish the material and go home.
Mm-hmm. This explains
too
why there's
not a very good answer.
Well, this explains too why there's so few pictures of you.
Yeah, well, I think that I don't think a writer should intrude between a piece of writing and a reader.
But you use the first person in your pieces.
Where I have to, if I have to. I mean, there are situations. If you're on a canoe trip with a group of people and you're one of the people, it would be ridiculous not to. And if there's other situations. I did a thing once about an experimental aircraft. It was called the deltoid pumpkin seed. And it was 60,000 words long, and there was one place in this whole story where I needed to appear as I, and that is that near the end, when this thing finally got itself going and was up off the ground, another person in the group got into a Cessna to fly up and fly with it, and I went with him. And at that point, I had to say, I got in the Cessna. Otherwise, how did this author suddenly appear 1,000 feet in the air? And so I took that into the New Yorker, and my editor there, Bob Bingham, said, that's just can't be. That it sticks out like a sore thumb, this I way over near the far end of the story. And he said, can't you find a place at least to do it one other time? And so I hunted around in the front of the piece and found a scene that happened in a Exxon station somewhere, and I put the I in there, and I still regret it. but only because it didn't belong. I mean, I'm not shy to say I if there's no alternative.
Well, John McPhee, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about writing. Thank you for your time.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
John McPhee's latest book, The Control of Nature, is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. McPhee is also a staff writer at The New Yorker. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, we'll have a live concert with the Borneo Horns. This saxophone trio plays the soulful, rhythmic new music compositions of Lenny Pickett. For years, Pickett played tenor sax with Tower of Power. He now performs with the Saturday Night Live Band and is one of the most sought-after studio musicians in New York. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Writer Terry McMillan once wrote, "As a black woman in America, it's disheartening and even frightening to accept the fact that because I've been labeled strong and independent, I'm viewed as a threat to black men, and my chances of finding Mr. Right are slim." In a way, that's half the story of McMillan's novel, Disappearing Acts. The other half is told from the perspective of a man. Coming up, we meet Terry McMillan. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead checks out Fractured Fairy Tales, the new album from alto saxophonist Tim Byrne and his septet. And this week, TV's most unlikely romance returns. TV critic David Bianculli reviews the season premiere of Beauty and the Beast. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
For National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush is defending his decision to send two top advisors to China over the weekend, despite that country's continuing repression of dissidents. National Security Advisor Brent Scowcroft and Deputy Secretary of State Lawrence Eagleburger are now back in Washington. The president today said the purpose of the visit was to brief the Chinese on the recent superpower summit meeting at Malta and to get China's views on the rapid changes in Eastern Europe. More from NPR's Ted Clark.
The Bush administration argues that China is a major world power that cannot be ignored, and that the talks in Beijing allowed the U.S. to press its concern about human rights. U.S. sanctions imposed after the Tiananmen Square massacre remain in place. In defending the weekend talks, President Bush said today they'd already produced one important result.
I must say I was very pleased today, in the wake of General Scowcroft's visit, to notice that the Chinese Foreign Ministry stated that they would not sell missiles to any Middle East countries,
as they have done in recent years. But this failed to satisfy some senior members of Congress. Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell said the Chinese have made no effort to improve human rights, and he called it a tragic irony that Mr. Bush's advisors went to Beijing on International Human Rights Day. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
Central American presidents meeting in Costa Rica are expected to announce a wide-ranging agreement. The two-day summit has gone remarkably smoothly, considering the recent escalation of conflicts in the region. But controversy has arisen over violence at an election rally in Nicaragua over the weekend. David Adams has this report from San Jose.
While the presidents were busy fine-tuning the accord, outside the meeting place, debate flourished over violence at a political rally in Nicaragua on Sunday. The rally in the town of Masatepe in Masaya province was organized by the main opposition alliance known as UNO. According to one American witness who was in Nicaragua to observe the electoral process at the invitation of the government, violence was provoked by Sandinista thugs who attacked with sticks and machetes. One man died and 11 others were injured. Bob Beckel, a former Democrat Party activist and presidential campaign manager for Walter Mondale in 1984, was so outraged by what he saw that he traveled to Costa Rica to denounce the attack at the summit. But the Nicaraguan government said the violence had been provoked by UNO members. The incident threatened briefly to upset the smooth progress of the summit talks. For National Public Radio, this is David Adams in San Jose.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrials closed down over 3 points to close at 2,728.24, on volume of some 148 million shares. Trading was moderate as declining issues outpaced advances 4-3. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Most self-produced jazz artists make a couple of albums, lose a pile of money, and give up. 10 years ago, alto saxophonist Tim Byrne put out his own records, which jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says were ambitious affairs that showcased Byrne's writing. But Byrne stuck with it. By the mid-'80s, he was recording for European jazz labels. By 1987, he was recording for mega-giant Columbia Records. Byrne had arrived, or had he?
Tim Byrne's career at Columbia Records ended after two albums, when the people there decided they hated his music. By the time his second Columbia disc turned up on critics' best of 1988 lists, including mine, it had already been dumped in 99-cent bins in record stores. That album, Sanctified Dreams, was ingeniously structured. It's a patchwork quilt of recurring ensemble strategies. The pieces are miniature suites. Taken one at a time, they might seem fragmented, but when you look at the whole thing, the music's larger pattern becomes clear. Burns' new record, Fractured Fairy Tales, is on the smaller, if still widely distributed, JMT label. But he's not crying in his beer. Fractured Fairy Tales is like the comedy version of Sanctified Dreams. That chuckling trumpeter is Herb Robertson, one of Tim Burns' frequent collaborators. As on previous records, Burns structures his music around angular melodies, sharp contrasts, and complex vamps. Burn also has a gift for writing haunting melodies, like this waltz, which features his own alto saxophone. As usual, Burn compresses a lot of musical information into a small space. His complete performance of Lightning Bug Bootay unfolds in under 40 seconds. Tim Burns' septet contains two interlocking trios. Burn, drummer Joey Barron, and cellist Hank Roberts make up a cooperative called Miniature. Roberts, violinist Mark Feldman, and bassist Mark Dresser work as the string trio Arcado. The album Fractured Fairy Tales takes its title from a segment on the late Jay Ward's Bullwinkle Show. Ward would take some durable old story and give it a screwball spin. A tale of a princess and a frog would end with the princess turning into another frog instead of the frog turning into a prince. In Tim Burns' Fractured Fairy Tales, his compositions are typically clever, but they sound like they're cracking under the cerebral pressure, like when Joey Barron uses synthesizer to play demented organ chords. Thank you. Over the years, Tim Burns' music has seesawed between being wide open and obsessively mapped out. Burns says his new album marks the end of a cycle, and the music he's been performing lately has been much looser. But Fractured Fairy Tales shows how well silliness and conceptual smarts can fit side by side.
Given Whitehead is a regular contributor to Downbeat and Cadence, he reviewed Tim Burns' Fractured Fairy Tales on the JMT label. This is Fresh Air. In a 1987 essay, Terry McMillan wrote, "Most of my girlfriends happen to be black, smart, ambitious, idealistic, over the age of 30, and professional. The silver thread that binds us is one that sometimes causes us embarrassment. We don't have a husband or a steady man in our lives, though most of us would like to." McMillan's latest novel, Disappearing Acts, is about a romance between a woman and a man who are so different from each other they each feel they are sacrificing part of their identities to keep the relationship together. Disappearing Acts is written in the alternating voices of the two main characters. Zora is a young teacher with ambitions to be a singer and songwriter. Franklin is a high school dropout who used to have a drug problem. He's a construction worker but is often out of work. I asked Terry McMillan what she most wanted to understand about Franklin by writing in his voice.
I think I wanted to understand his anger, his hurt, his sense of rage, and also his sense of disappointment in himself because he made some bad decisions, and as a result, he's suffering from them. And But I was trying to also understand how you deal with that. I wanted to get closer to his sense of helplessness. At the same time, he puts on this facade, you know, that he basically has it all together, that he is a super confident man. But underneath, he's not. He's pretty frightened.
Did you have a person to pattern his voice after?
Well, yes and no. He's sort of a culmination of a lot of voices. My brother, my ex, A lot of men that I've known over the years, and I sort of combined all of them. The ones that I think are not so much losers, but men who are pretty dissatisfied with the quality of their lives. And there's a similarity in the tone that I hear a lot of.
Mm-hmm. I want you to compare the two voices that you've written in, the voice of the main female character, Zora, and the main male character, Franklin. And this is deeper into the book. After they've had a baby, they're not married, and their relationship is really on the skids. She's supporting both of them. He's been laid off. He's been drinking a lot. And she's just bought him some... she just helped him start to do some woodworking in the house.
Mm-hmm.
The two excerpts I'm going to ask you to read is about picking the baby up from the daycare center. And the first excerpt is in Zora's voice.
Okay. When I walked in from work the next day, Franklin was hard at work. "Where's Jeremiah?" I asked. "Aw, shit. I knew it was something else I was supposed to do. Baby, I'll go get him right now." "He forgot?" "Never mind," I said. "Never mind. I'll get him tomorrow. I promise. I was just so into this, I got lost, baby. I got to change my measurements again. I'm sorry."
That was a chapter in Zora's voice, and part of that is a conversation with Franklin. Let me ask you to describe the same incident from Franklin's perspective.
Okay. Zora didn't even try to understand why I didn't want to pick Jeremiah up from the babysitter. She didn't have no idea how embarrassing that shit would have been for me. So I used waiting for a phone call on my woodworking as an excuse, but that wasn't it. I couldn't stand the thought that all the people in that house knew I wasn't working, knew it was Zora paying her, and I didn't want to be looked at and see the question in her eyes like, "What do you do all day?" What I do all day is drink and stare at the walls and listen to music.
So when you were writing Disappearing Act, mm-hmm. did you find yourself believing more in either of the two characters? Because you had to create both of them. You had to put your heart and soul into making both of them.
Initially, when I wrote this book, I was a little angry. And I think I didn't have as much compassion for Franklin. And the second time, third time around, the more I got into him, the more I did develop a lot more empathy for him, because I sort of started to understand what it was like not to be able to bring home the bacon and have a woman who was proud of you. As a woman who has been in a situation like this myself, I know what it's like from a woman's point of view, but I was more interested in exploring the male character's point of view, especially being a black man, and the fact that this guy tried, and what happens when you keep trying and you keep trying and nothing happens, and how you get worn out. So I think I came to understand that.
So do you buy his argument that he gives, for instance, in the excerpt that you just read, that he didn't want to pick up the baby at the babysitter because it would have been too embarrassing to let everybody know that he didn't have a job and that Zora was actually supporting him?
I think I buy it, but, you know, sometimes when things get rough, people use everything as an excuse mm-hmm. for not doing things. And I think this is just one more excuse that Franklin uses, even though for him it was probably valid. You know, I mean, that's part of what this whole thing is about. A lot of times we don't understand what it's like being in someone else's shoes. You know, all Zora was thinking about was that he did not pick the kid up from the babysitter and that here's one more thing she has to do.
The title of Disappearing Acts, in a way, refers to how sometimes part of your identity can disappear mm-hmm. when you fall in love with someone who makes certain demands of you, mm-hmm. you know. What kinds of things do you feel like you've sacrificed in relationships that led you to these conclusions? You know, parts of yourself that you found disappearing.
You mean personally?
Yeah.
Whoa. You know, I've always, I guess, been somewhat of a quote-unquote nurturer. And, you know, I've always been a believer and pretty too idealistic in a sense. And, you know, I think I've given up a lot of myself in order to help some men that I've dealt with in a romantic fashion to let them know that I believed in them. But the bottom line is that what I ended up finding out was that a lot of them didn't believe in themselves. And that's when I got drained, and I just said, later for this, I'm out of here. And it's happened to me a number of times. I mean, I'm 37 now. You know, all these men were, like, brilliant in their own terms. You know, had all these talents, from filmmakers to sculptors to photographers. I mean, all kinds of things. And they didn't have the faith in themselves that they displayed so vehemently in the beginning. And I always ended up getting disappointed. And I was sick of it. So I've had it. I mean, I'm not giving up on men. But the ones with the potential, I'm not into it anymore. I went through that in college.
When you say you're giving up on the men with potential, you mean giving up on thinking that somehow you'd be capable of helping them bring out that potential and getting them out of that rut of a failure and disappointment that they'd been in.
You got it. I mean, at 35 or 40 years old, if they don't already have a positive and, you know, a really good sense of who they are and what they're about, and if their values aren't intact and stuff, I don't want to be bothered. I'm sorry. I just can't handle it anymore. I have a 5-year-old son, and any man that comes into my life is going to have to be a role model. And plus, you know, I would like to be able to lean my head on someone's shoulder for a change instead of always having them lay theirs on mine. I mean, I can barely walk straight now.
You know, in your novel, as Franklin's confidence falls, he starts to get abusive and starts hitting Zora.
Well, he slaps her once.
You said the novel is very autobiographical, and I was mm-hmm. wondering if you knew what it felt like to be hit by a man and suddenly realize maybe this person isn't the person you thought. Maybe there's a side of him that you really didn't know, a side you don't want to get to know.
Well, I got slapped once, and I mean, I was shocked. I really couldn't believe it. But I whopped him back in the mouth and made his mouth bleed. He was shocked too. And then we sort of both just looked at each other. And, you know, I mean, I grew up seeing a lot of violence, not only in my household, but a whole lot of households. And I always knew that when I grew up, you know, any man that put his hands on me, that was it. He was history. And I told this man, you know, I'm not going to be one of these kind of women that you can, if you think you can do it now, you're going to continue. And, you know, today it's a smack, next time it's your fist. If this is the only way that you can handle your anger, I don't need to be around you.
Mm-hmm. Tell me how you first got published.
Ishmael Reed published a story. He was teaching at Berkeley at the time, and he, you know, I took this one workshop from him, and he told me that I had talent and that I could write. And I wrote this story that he ended up publishing in this literary quarterly that he was editing. And then there were, like, years later, I just continued to write because I never dreamed in a million years that I would one day be a quote-unquote writer. And it was nothing that I really aspired to. I just couldn't stop doing it. And then I won this fellowship for this story that I had started called Mama Take Another Step that ended up, thanks to the Harlem Writers Guild, becoming a novel. And sent it to Houghton Mifflin because I had this baby and I was 3 months behind in my rent and nothing was happening. And I said, what the hell? And it was for this fellowship. So I mailed it and they published it, to make a long story short.
I have one last question for you, and we only have about a minute left.
Okay.
The characters in your novel always watch Wheel of Fortune and mentally play along and figure out what it is that they've won. Weren't you actually a contestant on Wheel of Fortune?
Yes, I was.
How'd you get on?
Hey, let me tell you, it was crazy. I was visiting L.A. when my son Solomon was he was just turning one. And when I was breastfeeding, I used to watch Wheel of Fortune every day. That was the time I fed him. And, I mean, I won so many cars and trips and stuff. And I said, when I was going out there, I told my sister to call. And I went through this battery of tests, which were hard. And I got on, and I won a set of encyclopedias. That's what I picked out, because as a child, we never could afford them. And I got them. So it was a fantasy.
Well, Terry McMillan, thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Terry McMillan's latest novel, Disappearing Acts, is published by Viking. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and Check In with Noah Adams. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. On our program tonight, analysis of and reaction to the Bush administration's over-the-weekend mission to Beijing. High-level U.S. officials met there with China's leaders. Also, we'll talk with the editor of the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists about the doomsday clock that organization publishes. Right now, the hands are set for 6 minutes till midnight, and we'll find out if they intend to change the setting of the clock due to the recent changes in Eastern Europe. Also, we'll talk with Tony Randall, the actor, who'll tell some stories from his 40-year career on the stage and screen, taken from his new autobiography entitled Which Reminds Me.
Thanks, Noah. That and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This week marks the return of one of last season's most talked-about TV series. Television critic David Bianculli has a preview of Beauty and the Beast.
I was listening to Fresh Air the other day when Terry was interviewing Washington Post TV critic Tom Shales.
So what do you have to watch today?
Well, I just watched the two-hour return of Beauty and the Beast on CBS, which is on December 12th. Are you curious about that?
Not very.
No.
Is it any wonder I like working with Terry Gross? But hey, Beauty and the Beast has to be addressed sooner or later, and it looks like this is later. Last season, when the show was yanked from the CBS schedule for retooling, that's network talk for going back to the drawing board, rumors began to circulate among the Beauty and the Beast faithful. The big buzz, after a while, was that when the show returned, Linda Hamilton's character Catherine would be captured, tortured, killed, and pregnant, though not necessarily in that order. CBS's own ads say everything you've heard is true. Well, before I confirm whether the buzz was right, maybe I ought to give hardcore Beauty and the Beast fans the opportunity to turn down the volume for a minute or two. If you don't want to know what happens to Beauty and the Beast, don't listen for a while. Okay? Good. I thought they'd never leave. Now that we're alone, I can be honest. I've never understood what anybody saw in Beauty and the Beast. The only people who seem to like it are the ones who sat behind the bus driver in high school, the poetic sheltered types. Anyway, the gossip was right on the money. Catherine learns that she's pregnant, and Vincent, played by Ron Perlman, learns that he no longer has the psychic rapport he once shared with her.
There was a time when I could feel you coming to me. Feel you leering in the tunnels. It was a source of great joy radiating from you, filling me with joy. Tonight I waited until the sentry sent me a message that you were here.
What's different now?
It's gone.
What's gone?
The connection, our bond.
She's kidnapped by bad guys who imprison her for 6 months, deliver her baby, whisk it away, and inject her with a deadly drug. Vincent finally finds her, and they prove that they haven't forgotten each other.
Vincent.
Will this series find a new beauty for Vincent, or will it turn into a single-parent drama called Baby and the Beast? I have no idea. And frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
David Bianculli is television critic for the New York Post. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman, Richard Parker, and Dan Lachlan. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
You've probably seen and heard saxophonist Lenny Pickett playing in the Saturday Night Live band. On the next Fresh Air, Lenny Pickett joins us for a live concert with his own band, the Borneo Horns. Also, poet Michael Ryan reads from his latest collection, God Hunger. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.